This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Barracoon, the story of the last black cargo by Zora Neale Hurston. Edited and with an introduction by Deborah G. Plant. Performed by Robin Miles. Introduction by Deborah G. Plant. On December 14, 1927, Zora Neale Hurston took the 3:40 p.m. train from Penn Station, New York, to Mobile to conduct a series of interviews with the last surviving African of the last American slaver, the Clotilda. His name was Kozola, but he was called Cudjoe Lewis. He was held as a slave for 5.5 years in Plateau Magazine Point, Alabama, from 1860 until Union soldiers told him he was free. Kozola lived out the rest of his life in Africatown, Plateau. Hurston's trip south was a continuation of the field trip expedition she had initiated the previous year. Oluwale Kozola had survived capture at the hands of Dahomian warriors, the Barracoons at Whydah, and the Middle Passage. He had been enslaved, he had lived through the Civil War, and the largely unreconstructed South, and he had endured the rule of Jim Crow. He had experienced the dawn of a new millennium that included World War I and the Great Depression. Within the magnitude of world events swirled the momentous events of Kozola's own personal world. Zora Neale Hurston, as a cultural anthropologist, ethnographer, and folklorist, was eager to inquire into his experiences. "I want to know who you are," she approached Kozola, "and how you came to be a slave, and to what part of Africa do you belong, and how you fared as a slave, and how you have managed as a free man." Kozola absorbed her every question, then raised a tearful countenance. "Thank ye, Jesus. Somebody come asked about Cudjoe. I won't tell his somebody who I is. So maybe they go into Africa's soil someday and call him my name, and somebody say, 'Yeah, I know Kozola.'" Over a period of 3 months, Hurston visited with Kozola. She brought Georgia peaches, Virginia hams, late summer watermelons, and B brand insect powder. The offerings were as much a currency to facilitate their blossoming friendship as a means to encourage Kozola's reminiscences. Much of his life was a sequence of separations. Sweet things can be palliative. Kozola trusted Hurston to tell his story and transmit it to the world. Others had interviewed Kozola and had written pieces that focused on him, or more generally on the community of survivors at Africatown. But only Zora Neale Hurston conducted extensive interviews that would yield a comprehensive, book-length account of Kozola's life. She would alternately title the work Barracoon, The Story of the Last Black Cargo, and The Life of Kozola. As with the other interviews, Kozola hoped the story he entrusted to Hurston would reach his people, for whom he was still lonely. The disconnection he experienced was a source of continuous distress. Origins. Kozola was born circa 1841 in the town of Bante, the home to the Isha subgroup of the Yoruba people of West Africa. He was the second child of Fondlulu, who was the second of his father's three wives. His mother named him Kozola, meaning, "I do not lose my fruits anymore," or "My children do not die anymore." His mother would have 4 more children after Kozola, and he would have 12 additional siblings from his extended family. Fondlulu's name identified her as one who had been initiated as an Orisha devotee. His father was called Oluwale. Though his father was not of royal heritage, as Olu, which means king or chief, would imply, Kozula's grandfather was an officer of the king of their town and had land and livestock. By age 14, Kozula had trained as a soldier, which entailed mastering the skills of hunting, camping, and tracking, and acquiring expertise in shooting arrows and throwing spears. This training prepared him for induction into the secret male society called Oro. This society was responsible for the dispensation of justice and the security of the town. The Isha Yoruba of Bante lived in an agricultural society and were a peaceful people. Thus, the training of young men in the art of warfare was a strategic defense against bellicose nations. At age 19, Kozula was undergoing initiation for marriage. But these rites would never be realized. It was 1860, and the world Kozula knew was coming to an abrupt end. Transatlantic trafficking. By the mid-19th century, the Atlantic world had already penetrated the African hinterland. And although Britain had abolished the international trafficking of African peoples, or what is typically referred to as the transatlantic slave trade in 1807, and although the United States had followed suit in 1808, European and American ships were still finding their way to ports along the West African coast to conduct what was now deemed illegitimate trade. Laws had been passed and treaties had been signed, but half a century later, the deportation of Africans out of Africa and into the Americas continued. France and the United States had joined forces with British efforts to suppress the traffic. However, it was a largely British-led effort, and the U.S. patrols proved to be ambivalent and not infrequently at cross-purposes with the abolitionist agenda. Habituated to the lucrative enterprise of trafficking and encouraged by the relative ease with which they could find buyers for their captives, Africans opposed to ending the traffic persisted in the enterprise. The Fon of Dahomey was foremost among those African peoples who resisted the suppression. Not only was the internal enslavement of their prisoners perceived as essential to their traditions and customs, the external cell of their prisoners afforded their kingdom wealth and political dominance. To maintain a sufficient slave supply, the King of Dahomey instigated wars and led raids with the sole purpose of filling the royal stockade. King Gezo of Dahomey renounced his 1852 treaty to abolish the traffic, and by 1857 had resumed his wars and raids. Reports of his activities had reached the newspapers of Mobile, Alabama. A November 9, 1858 article announced that the King of Dahomey was driving a brisk trade at Whydah. This article caught the attention of Timothy Mayer, a slaveholder who, like many pro-slavery Americans, wanted to maintain the transatlantic traffic. In defiance of constitutional law, Mayer decided to import Africans illegally into the country and enslave them. In conspiracy with Mayer, William Foster, who built the Clotilda, outfitted the ship for transport of the contraband cargo. In July 1860, he navigated toward the Bight of Benin. After 6 weeks of surviving storms and avoiding being overtaken by ships patrolling the waters, Foster anchored the Clotilda at the port of Whydah. Barracoon. From 1801 to 1866, an estimated 3,873,600 Africans were exchanged for gold, guns, and other European and American merchandise. Of that number, approximately 444,700 were deported from the Bight of Benin, which was controlled by Dahomey. During the period from 1851 to 1860, approximately 22,500 Africans were exported, and of that number, 110 were taken aboard the Clotilda at Whydah. Kozula was among them, a transaction between Foster and King Glele. In 1859, King Gezo was mortally shot while returning from one of his campaigns. His son Bado Hun had ascended to the throne. He was called Glele, which means the ferocious lion of the forest, or terror in the bush. To avenge his father's death, as well as to amass sacrificial bodies for certain imminent traditional ceremonies, Glele intensified the raiding campaigns. Under the pretext of having been insulted when the king of Bante refused to yield to Glele's demands for corn and cattle, Glele sacked the town. Kozulo described to Hurston the mayhem that ensued in the pre-dawn raid when his townspeople awoke to Dahomey's female warriors who slaughtered them in their days. Those who tried to escape through the 8 gates that surrounded the town were beheaded by the male warriors who were posted there. Kozulo recalled the horror of seeing decapitated heads hanging about the belts of the warriors, and how on the second day, the warriors stopped the march in order to smoke the heads. Through the clouds of smoke, he missed seeing the heads of his family and townspeople. "It is easy to see how few would have looked on that sight too closely," wrote a sympathetic Hurston. Along with a host of others taken as captives by the Dahomeyan warriors, the survivors of the Bante massacre were yoked by forked sticks and tied in a chain, then marched to the stockades at Abomey. After 3 days, they were incarcerated in the barracoons at Wida, near the Bight of Benin. During the weeks of his existence in the barracoons, Kozulo was bewildered and anxious about his fate. Before him was a thunderous and crashing ocean that he had never seen before. Behind him was everything he called home. There in the barracoon, as there in his Alabama home, Kozulo was transfixed between two worlds, fully belonging to neither. Cudjoe's own story. Prior to their December 1927 meeting, Hurston had interviewed Kozulo once before. As she states in her introduction to Barracoon, "I had met Cudjoe Lewis for the first time in July 1927. I was sent by Dr. Franz Boas to get a first-hand report of the raid that had brought him to America and bondage for Dr. Carter G. Woodson of the Journal of Negro History." From February to August of 1927, Hurston conducted field work in Florida and Alabama under the direction of Franz Boas, her mentor, the renowned father of American anthropology. Boas had early on approached Woodson, the father of black history, about a fellowship for Hurston in support of the research. In accordance with their arrangements, Hurston was to collect black folk materials for Boas and scout around for undiscovered black folk artists. In addition to the gathering of historical data for Woodson, she was also to collect Kozulo's story. Woodson supported Hurston's field research with a $1,400 fellowship. Half of the funds came from the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, an organization founded and directed by Woodson. Elsie Clues Parsons of the American Folklore Society granted matching funds. As a fellow and investigator for the association, Hurston was expected to contribute material to the Journal of Negro History, a publication of the association. During the latter part of her time in the field, Hurston drove to Plateau, Alabama, to undertake her last task for Woodson and conduct the interview with Kozulo. Along with various reports and archival data, Hurston submitted to Woodson materials she had collected on Fort Mosey, a black settlement in St. Augustine, Florida. Woodson published this material as an article entitled Communications in the October 1927 issue of the Journal. In the same issue, he published Hurston's Kozulo interview as Cudjoe's Own Story of the Last African Slaver. A footnote at the beginning of the article stated that, as an investigator of the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History, Zora Neale Hurston had traveled to Mobile to interview Lewis, the only survivor of this last cargo. The note states further, She made some use, too, of the voyage of Clotilda and other records of the Mobile Historical Society. In reality, Hurston made more than a little use of the Society's records, and though part of the article was a first-hand report, the larger portion of the article was second-hand information drawn from Emma Langdon Roche's Historic Sketches of the South, 1914. Emma Roche was a writer, artist, and farmer born in Alabama in 1878. Her book is an account of the origins of slavery in America, couched in pro-slavery tenets and paternalistic perspectives. Her narrative recounts the history of the Clotilda and follows the fate of the Africans who were stored in its hold. Only decades later, with the literary critic and Hurston biographer Robert Hemingway, bring the matter of Hurston's borrowing to scholarly attention and discussion. Hemingway credits the findings to the linguist William Stewart, who discerned it in 1972. Stewart's discovery was conveyed to me, Hemingway noted in Zora Neale Hurston, a literary biography, by John Swed of the University of Pennsylvania. I am grateful to Professor Stewart for granting me permission to cite his research and findings. Though the footnote in her 1927 article acknowledges the Mobile Historical Society as a secondary source, it does not reference historic sketches specifically, and Hurston makes no direct reference to Roche's book within the body of the article itself. Rather, improperly documented paraphrased passages and near-verbatim appropriations from Roche's work constitute the larger part of the article. Of the 67 paragraphs in Hurston's essay, Hemingway relates only 18 are exclusively her own prose. Hemingway speculates that Hurston found her interview with Kusula lacking in original material and therefore resorted to the use of Roche's work to supplement it. He supposes, too, that Hurston, writing at the outset of her career, suffered a quandary of purpose, direction, and methodology. How exactly was she to introduce the world to African-American folklore, which she perceived to be the greatest cultural wealth on the continent? Hemingway observed that Hurston, as one of the folk herself, struggled to negotiate the sociocultural chasm between her rural hometown of Eatonville, Florida, and the wealthy enclaves of New York City. He believed that her frustration with the academic study and presentation of the African-American folk and folk culture was a reflection of the same struggle. Hurston had imbibed Boas's theory of cultural relativity and understood that there were no superior or inferior cultures. She understood that cultures were to be assessed and evaluated on their own terms. But were the methods of Boas and Woodson conducive to her purposes? Was it possible that the repertorial precision of Western scientific investigation could be the means by which she would document and celebrate African-American genius and thereby challenge European imperialism and Euro-American cultural hegemony? Or did she believe, as did poet Audre Lorde, that the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house? In a letter to her friend Thomas Jones, the president of Fisk University, Hurston articulated her conundrum. "Returned to New York and began to rewrite and arrange the material for scientific publications, and while doing so, began to see the pity of all the flaming glory of being buried in scientific journals." She was dubious about Boas's objective observer approach to folklore collection, and she chafed under Woodson's brand of scholarship. She preferred to be in the field, writes Hemingway, and so resented the time she spent investigating court records and mindlessly transcribing historical documents. Nonetheless, Hemingway wondered why Hurston would risk her career and whether her plagiaristic use of Roche's work was an unconscious attempt at academic suicide. This attempt, Hemingway concludes, is made because of a lack of respect for the writing one has to do. If detected and her scientific integrity destroyed, Hurston's academic career would have been finished. She would then have been free from Boaz's admonitions and Woodson's demands and the unglamorous labor of collecting folklore. Is it possible, Hemingway speculates further, that footnotes referencing Roche had been included but were lost or otherwise omitted from the other records to which the article's footnote alludes? In any case, Hemingway states that Hurston's career needs no absurd apologetics. She never plagiarized again. She became a major folklore collector. Hurston's biographer Valerie Boyd has proposed that even though Hurston resented the hack work she did for Woodson, it is also just as likely that Hurston believed the report was only for Woodson's files. She did not expect it to be published, any more than she thought her transcribed communication was worthy of publication. The communications article was a compilation of transcribed excerpts from letters and historical and congressional documents strung together with brief transitional statements. This style of reporting bears comparison with the composition of Cudjoe's own story. Boyd wondered whether Hurston's submission of material that contained only 25% of her original work might have been Hurston's way of getting back at Woodson for arbitrarily slicing her pay and cutting into her research time by having her do his dreck work. Hurston had complained to her friend, the poet Langston Hughes, that she had finished her work for Woodson but wasn't paid in full. "I thought I'd get paid for the month, but he only paid me for 2 weeks." She vented to Hughes and told him that she felt depressed about the matter. As Hemingway conjectured that Hurston may have saved the juicy bits of her folklore finds for theatrical collaborations with Langston Hughes, Boyd conjectured that Hurston had resolved to save her most compelling material from Cudjoe Lewis for her own work. Cozzulla had gained some celebrity as the last living survivor of the Clotilda. Other anthropologists, folklorists, historians, journalists, and artists alike had sought him out. Hurston's colleague Arthur Huff Fawcett had already collected from Cozzulla the folktale Tappan, Terrapin, which he published in Alan Locke's 1925 The New Negro, An Interpretation. Speculations aside, Boyd states, "Making some use of material from another writer is completely common and acceptable. But as Zora knew, copying another's work and passing it off as one's own is not." It is possible that the compromised article may have both relieved Hurston of tedium and allowed her a boon of lore for her own purposes, thereby hitting a straight lick with a crooked stick. Or, as Linda Marion Hill suggests in Social Rituals and the Verbal Art of Zora Neale Hurston, Hurston's professional faux pas may have been an instance of Hurston masking her emotional response to a troubling event. In 1927, Zora Neale Hurston was new. Although Hemingway may have agreed with Franz Boas that Hurston was a little too impressed with her own accomplishments, it is equally true that she herself was still very much impressionable. In 1927, the career to which critics allude was in the future. Hurston was not the seasoned social scientist who had published the folklore collections Mules and Men, 1935, and Tell My Horse, 1938. She was not the author of 4 novels, including the celebrated Their Eyes Were Watching God, 1937. She was yet at the beginning of things. Cudjoe's Own Story was Hurston's debut scholarly publication. In writing her first essay on Cudjoe, Linda Hill surmises Hurston might have been too moved and too uncertain how to manage her subjective response, rather than too frustrated with the rigors of scientific analysis to produce an authentic text. As Hurston reflected on her interview with Cozzulla years later in her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road, "It gave me something to feel about." The interview changed Hurston, Hill observes. This elder, an Isha Yoruba in America, had schooled her in the socio-political and cultural complexities of my people. In face of Kusula's recollections, the social constructions of my people and Africans were deconstructed by the reality of ethnic identifications, which not only distinguished tribes and clans, but also generated the narrative distance and the ideological difference that rendered one ethnic group capable of regarding another as stranger or enemy, and allowed that group to offer up the other to the transatlantic trade. One thing impressed me strongly from this 3 months of association with Kodjo Lewis, Hurston writes. The white people had held my people in slavery in America. They had bought us, it is true, and exploited us. But the inescapable fact that stuck in my craw was, my people had sold me, and the white people had bought me. That did away with the folklore I had been brought up on. That the white people had gone to Africa, waved a red handkerchief at the Africans, and lured them aboard ship and sailed away. Hurston was a collector of folklore. However, the folklore she was brought up on contradicted the folklore she was collecting from Kusula. Moreover, all that this Kodjo told me, Hurston mused, was verified from other historical sources. Harlem Renaissance pundits and artists like Zora Neale Hurston were wrestling with the identity of the Negro. They had reclaimed the image of black people and asserted the value of black culture vis-a-vis white people and Anglo-American culture. There was a decided movement to do away with the image of the old Negro and usher in the new Negro, whose authentic culture and ethos were rooted in African origins. How did the butchering and killing of African others and the extirpation of whole societies fit within the profile of this modern, authentic, new Negro? Might Hurston have attempted to avoid the inescapable fact of that dimension of African humanity that was motivated by the universal nature of greed and glory? Could it be that the woman and social scientist whose objectives entailed the discovering and uncovering of African cultural retentions in America was blindsided by Kusula's recollection of the inhumanity that was integral to his delivery at the port of Whydah? Perhaps, rather than force herself to deal with such disorienting facts that stuck in her craw, Hurston chose in that moment to submit a narrative about the raid that had already been penned. Although justifying plagiarism is impossible, Hill writes, the reasons for it should be scrutinized in light of its being, to date, a one-time occurrence in the long, productive career of a prolific and widely published author. Hill's perspective is an important one, especially given the fact that Hemingway levels a similar charge, condemning and dismissing Barracoon, as though the manuscript were but an extension of the earlier published Kodjo Lewis piece. It is not. Hemingway proclaims that the article published in the journal was an anomaly, and reports that Hurston returned to Mobile to interview Kusula anew, and did so with greater success. Barracoon, the book-length work, was the result of her efforts. Yet, even this unpublished manuscript, written in 1931, writes Hemingway, makes extensive use of Roche and other anthropological sources, although it skillfully weaves together the scholarship and Hurston's own memories of Kodjo. It does not acknowledge those sources, and it is the type of book that Boas would have repudiated. Hemingway writes further, the book purports to be solely the words of Kodjo. In fact, it is Hurston's imaginative recreation of his experience. Her purpose was to recreate slavery from a black perspective, but she was doing so as an artist rather than as a folklorist. Although the journal article and the book manuscript have a common subject in Kusula, they are two distinct works. And where the charge of plagiarism is reasonable with the first, it is unfounded with the second. Hurston does draw on Roche's work in Barracoon, and she acknowledges it only indirectly. In her preface to Barracoon, she writes, "For historical data, I am indebted to the Journal of Negro History and to the records of the Mobile Historical Society." In her introduction, Hurston describes her interviews with Kusula and states, "Thus, from Cudjo and from the records of the Mobile Historical Society, I had the story of the last load of slaves brought into the United States." In her use of Roche's work, as with her use of other secondary materials, Hurston makes a good faith effort in Barracoon to document her sources. She does paraphrase passages from historical sketches, and she places direct quotes within quotation marks, though in the manuscript draft, she is inconsistent in this. And some sources are actually documented within the text of the introduction, and others are footnoted within the body of the narrative. The historian Sylvian Diouf states that Hemingway's characterization of Hurston's manuscript was uncalled for. She may have conflated some of what Cudjo said with some of what she knew as a scholar, but she made a genuine effort at separating the two. With few exceptions, the information provided in Barracoon is confirmed by other sources. Witnesses, experts in Yoruba cultures, contemporary newspaper articles, and abundant archival material corroborate the various events in Cudjo's life as described in Barracoon. Far from being a fictionalized recreation, Diouf writes, "Cudjo's story, as transmitted by Hurston, is as close to veracity as can possibly be ascertained with the help of other records." She states further that Hurston had produced an invaluable document on the lives of a group of people with a unique experience in American history. Rather than repudiate her, Boas might well have been pleased and encouraging, as Hurston, in this early phase of her professional writing, endeavored to utilize historical records to support her folklore findings, just as both Boas and Woodson had instructed. What is more significant is that Hurston was struggling to appease neither Boas nor Woodson, but was engaged in the process of actualizing her vision of herself as a social scientist and an artist who was determined to present Kusula's story in as authentic a manner as possible. Kusula Hurston, Charlotte Mason, and Barracoon. In September 1927, Hurston had met and come under contract with Charlotte Osgood Mason, a patron to several Harlem Renaissance luminaries. Mason funded Hurston's return to Alabama for the extended interviews with Kusula, and she supported Hurston's research efforts while preparing Barracoon for publication. In a March 25, 1931 letter to Mason, Hurston writes that the work is coming along well. She reported that she had to revise some passages, but that she was within a few paragraphs of the end of the whole thing, then for the final typing. She described the revisions and related her new research findings. "I found at the library an actual account of the raid, as Kusula said that it happened. Also the tribe name. It was not on the maps because the entire tribe was wiped out by the Dahomey troops. The king who conquered them preserved carefully the skull of Kusula's king as a most worthy foe." Hurston and Mason conversed about the potential publication of Barracoon over a period of years. In her desire to see Hurston financially independent, Mason encouraged Hurston to prepare Barracoon, as well as the material that would become Mules and Men, for publication. Charlotte Mason considered herself not only a patron to black writers and artists, but also a guardian of black folklore. She believed it her duty to protect it from those whites who, having no more interesting things to investigate among themselves, were grabbing in every direction material that by right belongs entirely to another race. Following the suggestions of Mason and Alan Locke, Hurston advised Kusula and his family to avoid talking with other folklore collectors, white ones, no doubt, who he and Godmother felt should be kept entirely away, not only from the project in hand, but from this entire movement for the rediscovery of our folk material. Mason's support of Hurston's efforts with Barracoon extended to monetary contributions to Kusula's welfare. Mason and Kusula would eventually communicate directly with each other, and Kusula would come to consider Mason a dear friend. As one letter suggests, Kusula was struggling financially. It had come to Mason's attention that Kusula had used excerpts from his copy of Hurston's narrative to gain financial compensation from local newspapers. Kusula dictated a letter to Mason in response to her concern. "Dear friend, you may have seen in the papers about my history, but this has been over 3 years since I has let anyone take it off to copy from it. I only did that so they would help me. But there is no one did for me as you has. The Lord will bless you and will give you a long life. Where there's no more parting, yours in Christ, Cudjoe Lewis." As Mason was protective of Hurston's professional interests, both women remained concerned about Kosula's welfare. Having discovered that Kusula was not receiving money that Mason had mailed to him, Hurston looked into the matter. She updated Mason accordingly. "I have written to Claudia Thornton to check up on Kusula and all about things. I have also asked the post office at Plateau to check any letters coming to Cudjoe Lewis from New York." As Hurston checked on Kusula, she continued revising the manuscript. "Second writing of Kusula all done and about typed," she wrote Mason on January 12, 1931. On April 18th, she was enthusiastic. "At last, Barracoon is ready for your eyes." Appreciative of Mason's support, Hurston dedicated the book to her and began submitting it to publishers. In September 1931, she contemplated Viking's proposal. The Viking press again asks for the life of Kusula, but in language rather than dialect. "It lies here, and I know your mind about that, and so I do not answer them except with your tongue." The dialect was a vital and authenticating feature of the narrative. Hurston would not submit to such revision. Perhaps, as Langston Hughes wrote in The Big C, the Negro was no longer in vogue, and publishers like Bonney and Viking were unwilling to take risks on Negro material during the Great Depression. The Griot. There seems to be a note of disappointment in Diouf's revelation that Hurston submitted Barracoon to various publishers, but it never found a taker and has still not been published. Hurston's manuscript is an invaluable historical document, as Diouf points out, and an extraordinary literary achievement as well, despite the fact that it found no takers during her lifetime. In it, Zora Neale Hurston found a way to produce a written text that maintains the orality of the spoken word, and she did so without imposing herself in the narrative, creating what some scholars classify as orature. Contrary to Hemingway's dismissal of Barracoon as Hurston's recreation of Kusula's experience, Hill writes that, through a deliberate act of suppression, she resists presenting her own point of view in a natural or naturalistic way and allows Kusula to tell his story in his own way. Zora Neale Hurston was not only committed to collecting artifacts of African-American folk culture, she was also adamant about their authentic presentation. Even as she rejected the objective observer stance of Western scientific inquiry for a participant observer stance, Hurston still incorporated standard features of the ethnographic and folklore collecting processes within her methodology. Adopting the participant observer stance is what allowed her to collect folklore like a new broom. As Hill points out, Hurston was simultaneously working and learning, which meant ultimately that she was not just mirroring her mentors, but that she was coming into her own. Embedded in the narrative of Barracoon are those aspects of ethnography and folklore collecting that reveal Hurston's methodology and authenticate Kosula's story as his own, rather than as a fiction of Hurston's imagination. The story, in the main, is told from Kosula's first-person point of view. Hurston transcribes Kosula's story using his vernacular diction, spelling his words as she hears them pronounced. Sentences follow his syntactical rhythms and maintain his idiomatic expressions and repetitive phrases. Hurston's methods respect Kosula's own storytelling sensibility. It is one that is rooted in African soil. It would be hard to make the case that she entirely invented Kosula's language and, consequently, his emerging persona, comments Hill, and it would be an equally hard case to make that she created the life events chronicled in Kosula's story. Even as Hurston has her own idea about how a story is to be told, Kosula has his. Hurston is initially impatient with Kosula's talk about his father and grandfather, for instance, but Kosula's proverbial wisdom adjusts her attitude. Where is the house where the mouse is the leader? Hurston complained in Dust Tracks on a Road of Kosula's reticence, yet her patience in getting his story is quite apparent in the narrative. She is persistent in her returning to his home, even when Kosula petulantly sends her away. He doesn't always talk when she comes, but rather chooses to tend his garden or repair his fence. And sometimes her time with him is spent driving Kosula into town. Sometimes he is lost in his memories. Recording such moments within the body of the narrative not only structures the overall narrative flow of events, but reveals the behavioral patterns of her informant. As Hurston is not just an observer, she fully participates in the process of helping Kosula to tell his story. In writing his story, says Hill, Hurston does not romanticize or in any way imply that ideals such as self-fulfillment or fully realized self-expression could emerge from such suffering as Kosula has known. Hurston does not intercept his comments, except when she builds a transition from one interview to the next, in her footnotes, and at the end when she summarizes. The story Hurston gathers is presented in such a way that she, the interlocutor, all but disappears. The narrative space she creates for Kosula's unburdening is sacred. Rather than insert herself into the narrative as the learned and probing cultural anthropologist, the investigating ethnographer, or the authorial writer, Zora Neale Hurston, in her still listening, assumes the office of a priest. In this space, Oluwale Kosula passes his story of epic proportion on to her. Barracoon. To Charlotte Mason, my godmother, and the one mother of all the primitives, who with the gods in space is concerned about the hearts of the untaught. Preface. This is the life story of Cudjoe Lewis, as told by himself. It makes no attempt to be a scientific document, but on the whole he is rather accurate. If he is a little hazy as to detail after 67 years, he is certainly to be pardoned. The quotations from the works of travelers in Dahomey are set down, not to make this appear a thoroughly documented biography, but to emphasize his remarkable memory. Three spellings of his nation are found, A-T-T-A-K-O, T-A-C-C-O-U, and T-A-C-C-O-W. But Lewis's pronunciation is probably correct. Therefore, I have used T-A-K-K-O-I throughout the work. I was sent by a woman of tremendous understanding of primitive peoples to get this story. The thought back of the act was to set down essential truth rather than fact of detail, which is so often misleading. Therefore, he has been permitted to tell his story in his own way, without the intrusion of interpretation. For historical data, I am indebted to the Journal of Negro History and to the records of the Mobile Historical Society. Zora Neale Hurston, April 17th, 1931. Introduction. The African slave trade is the most dramatic chapter in the story of human existence. Therefore, a great literature has grown up about it. Innumerable books and papers have been written. These are supplemented by the vast lore that has been blown by the breath of inarticulate ones across the seas and lands of the world. Those who justified slaving on various grounds have had their say. Among these are several slave runners who have boasted of their exploits in the contraband flesh. Those who stood aloof in loathing have cried out against it in lengthy volumes. All the talk, printed and spoken, has had to do with ships and rations, with sail and weather, with ruses and piracy and balls between wind and water, with native kings and bargains sharp and sinful on both sides, with tribal wars and slave factories and red massacres, and all the machinations necessary to stock a barracoon with African youth on the first leg of their journey from humanity to cattle, with storing and feeding and starvation and suffocation and pestilence and death, with slave ship stenches and mutinies of crew and cargo, with the jettying of cargoes before the guns of British cruisers, with auction blocks and sales and profits and losses. All these words from the seller, but not one word from the sold. The kings and captains whose words moved ships, but not one word from the cargo. The thoughts of the black ivory, the coin of Africa, had no market value. Africa's ambassadors to the New World have come and worked and died and left their spore, but no recorded thought. Of all the millions transported from Africa to the Americas, only one man is left. He is called Cudjoe Lewis and is living at present at Plateau, Alabama, a suburb of Mobile. This is the story of this Cudjoe. I had met Cudjoe Lewis for the first time in July 1927. I was sent by Dr. Franz Boas to get a first-hand report of the raid that had brought him to America and bondage for Dr. Carter G. Woodson of the Journal of Negro History. I had talked with him in December of that same year and again in 1928. Thus, from Cudjoe and from the records of the Mobile Historical Society, I had the story of the last load of slaves brought into the United States. The four men responsible for this last deal in human flesh, before the surrender of Lee at Appomattox should end the 364 years of Western slave trading, were the three Mayer brothers and one captain, William Bill Foster. Jim, Tim, and Burns Mayer were natives of Maine. They had a mill and shipyard on the Alabama River at the mouth of Chickasabogue Creek, now called Three Mile Creek, where they built swift vessels for blockade running, filibustering expeditions, and river trade. Captain Foster was associated with the Mayers in business. He was born in Nova Scotia of English parents. There are various reasons given for this trip to the African coast in 1859, with the muttering thunder of secession heard from one end of the United States to the other. Some say that it was done as a prank to win a bet. That is doubtful. Perhaps they believed, with many others, that the abolitionists would never achieve their ends. Perhaps they merely thought of the probable profits of the voyage and so undertook it. The Clotilda was the fastest boat in their possession, and she was the one selected to make the trip. Captain Foster seems to have been the actual owner of the vessel. Perhaps that is the reason he sailed in command. The clearance papers state that she was sailing for the West Coast for a cargo of red palm oil. Foster had a crew of Yankee sailors and sailed directly for Ouida, the slave port of Dahomey. The Clotilda slipped away from Mobile as secretly as possible so as not to arouse the curiosity of the government. It had a good voyage to within a short distance of the Cape Verde Islands. Then, a hurricane struck, and Captain Foster had to put in there for repairs. While he was on dry dock, his crew mutinied. They demanded more pay under the threat of informing a British man of war that was at hand. Foster hurriedly promised the increase the sailors demanded, but his wife often told how he laughingly broke this promise when it was safe to do so. After the repairs had been made, he made presents to the Portuguese officials of shawls and other trinkets and sailed away unmolested. Soon he was safely anchored in the Gulf of Guinea before Whydah. There being no harbor, ships must stand in open roadstead, and the communications with shore are carried on by crewmen in their surf boats. Soon Captain Foster and his kegs of specie and trading goods were landed. 6 stalwart blacks were delegated to meet him and conduct him into the presence of a prince of Dahomey, but he did not meet the king. Foster was borne in a hammock to the prince, who received him seated on his stool of rank. He was gracious and hospitable, and had Foster shown the sights of Whydah. He was surrounded by evidence of great wealth, and Foster was impressed. He was particularly struck by a large square enclosure filled with thousands of snakes, which he was told had been collected for ceremonial purposes. The prince expressed regret that Foster had arrived a little too late to witness the Dahomey custom in honor of trade, foreign, i.e., mostly slave trade. Nevertheless, he found Foster's company so pleasant that he wished to make him a present. He therefore desired Foster to look about him and select a person, one that the superior wisdom and exalted taste of Foster designated the finest specimen. Foster looked about him and chose a young man named Gompa. Foster, making this selection with the intention of flattering the prince, to whom Gompa was nearly related. This accounts for the one Dahomey in the cargo. The ceremonies over, Foster had little trouble in procuring a cargo. The barracoons at Whydah were overflowing. It had long been a part of the trader's policy to instigate the tribes against each other, so that plenty of prisoners would be taken, and, in this manner, keep the market stocked. News of the trade was often published in the papers. An excerpt from the Mobile Register of November 9, 1858, said, "From the west coast of Africa, we have advice dated September 21st. The quarreling of the tribes on Sierra Leone River rendered the aspect of things very unsatisfactory." Inciting was no longer necessary in Dahomey. The King of Dahomey had long ago concentrated all his resources on the providing of slaves for the foreign market. There was a brisk trade in slaves at from $50 to $60 apiece at Whydah. Immense numbers of Negroes were collected along the coast for export. King Gezo maintained a standing army of about 12,000, and of these, 5,000 are Amazons. The Dahomey year was divided into 2 parts, the wars and the festivals. In the months of November or December, the king commences his annual wars, and these wars were kept up until January or February. These were never carried on for mere conquest. They were all forced upon the Dahomeys from less powerful nations. The king boasted that he never attacked a people unless they had not only insulted Dahomey, but his own people must ask him for a war against the aggressors for 3 successive years. Then, and then only, would he let himself be persuaded to march forth and exterminate the insulting tribe. But there were so many insulting chiefs and kings that it kept the warriors of Dahomey, reluctant as they were, always upon the warpath. Whole nations are transported, exterminated, their name to be forgotten, except in the annual festival of their conquerors, when sycophants call the names of the vanquished countries to the remembrance of the victors. When the Dahomey king marched forth against a place, he concealed from his army the name or the place against which he has brought them, until within a day's march of the goal. Daylight is generally the time of onset, and every cunning, secrecy, and ingenuity is exercised to take the enemy by surprise. With or without resistance, all the aged were decapitated on the spot, and the youth driven to the barracoons at Widder. On the return from war in January, the king resides at Cana and makes a fetish. That is, he sacrifices largely and gives liberal presents to the people, and at the same time purchases the prisoners and heads from his soldiers of those slain in war. The heads are always cut off and carried home. No warrior may boast of more enemies slain than he has heads to show for. The slaves are then sold to the slave merchants, and their blood money wasted in the ensuing custom, Hue no o Iwa, as the great annual feast is entitled in Dahomen parlance. The most important feast is held in March and called Si Ke Ahi, at which the king sacrifices many slaves and makes a great display of his wealth. There is a lesser festival in May or June, in honor of trade, which is celebrated with music, dancing, and singing. In July is celebrated the royal salute to the fetish of the great waters. Therefore, when Captain Foster arrived in May, the wars being just over for the year, he had a large collection to choose from. The people he chose had been in the stockade behind the great white house for less than a month. He selected 130, equal number of men and women, paid for them, got into his hammock, and was conveyed across the shallow river to the beach, and was shot through the surf by the skillful crew boys and joined his ship. In other boats manipulated by the crew boys were his pieces of property. When 116 of the slaves had been brought aboard, Foster, up in the rigging, observing all the activities of the port through his glasses, became alarmed. He saw all the Dahomen ships suddenly run up black flags. He hurried down and gave orders to abandon the cargo not already on board, and to sail away with all speed. He says that the Dahomens were treacherously planning to recapture the cargo he had just bought and hold him for ransom. But the Clotilda was so expertly handled, and her speed was so great, that she sped away to safety with all ease. The next day he was chased by an English cruiser, but escaped by pressing on sail. Nothing eventful happened until the 13th day, when he ordered the cargo brought on deck so that they might regain the use of their limbs. Though the space in the Clotilda greatly exceeded the usual space in most slavers, the blacks were cramped. The usual space in which the middle passage was made was from 2.5 to 3 feet in height. It was about 5 feet in the Clotilda. However, the lack of action had numbed them. On the 20th day, Foster thought he saw a British cruiser on the horizon intercepting his course. He climbed to the mast with his glasses. Yes, there she was, sweeping on toward his course. He hurried down and gave orders for the slaves to be returned to the hold. Then he anchored and lay until night, when he resumed his course. When Captain Foster reached American waters, the slaves were put back in the hold. The ship lay hidden for 3 days, behind the islands in Mississippi Sound and near the lower end of Mobile Bay. To make the hiding more secure, the Clotilda was dismasted. Then Foster got into a small boat, rowed by 4 sailors, to go to the western shore of Mobile Bay, intending to send word to Mayer that the Clotilde had arrived. His approach was regarded with suspicion by some men ashore, and he was fired upon. Waving a white handkerchief, their doubts were allayed, and he offered $50 for a conveyance which would take him to Mobile. Captain Foster reached Mobile on a Sunday morning in August, 1859. His return from the slave coast having been made in 70 days. Arrangements had long been made that a tug should lie in readiness to go at a moment's notice down Mobile Bay to tow the Clotilde and her cargo to safety. When the news came, the tug's pilot was attending services at St. John's Church. Captain Jim Mayer and James Dennison, a Negro slave, hurried to the church and called the pilot out. The three hastened down to the wharf and were soon aboard the tug. It proceeded down the bay, but waited till dark to approach the Clotilda. Finally, the tug was made fast to the Clotilda, and the trip up the bay was begun. The last slave ship was at the end of its voyage. The tug avoided the Mobile River Channel, slipped behind the lighthouse on Battery Gladden into Spanish River. As the Clotilda passed opposite Mobile, the clock in the old Spanish tower struck 11.